George Saunders. Time magazine has described him as the best short story writer in English. I'm willing to bet he's one of the best short story writers in any language. George's latest collection is called Liberation Day. It's his first in nearly a decade, since the critically acclaimed collection 10th of December. Is it possible that George's latest short story collection finds his writing even more suitably Saunders-esque than his previous one? Yes, it is, dear listener. Yes, it is. There's something very special about a George Saunders story. There's his trademark humor, his love and respect for humanity, and the kindness and tremendous empathy that he shows for his reader. He joined us from his home in California to talk about the collection and why he titled it Liberation Day.
At the end of a book of stories, I just look at all the titles of the individual stories, and the assumption is that one of those will be the book title. What I'll do is I'll kind of, you know, put each of the stories on a separate index card and put them on the kitchen counter and kind of just think through it with that, you know, proposed title in mind. And when I got to Liberation Day, something kind of sparked, because I think in every one of the stories, there's somebody who is kind of fed up with the way things have always been for him or for her and wants to make that big change, you know, that one we all long for, after which we'll be completely happy and high-functioning and not neurotic. And so in each of the story, there's some kind of resolution to fix things once and for all. Mostly those don't go that well because we're human beings. But what I'll do is I'll have the title in mind, kind of scan each story and see if there's any relation at all between the book title and the story. And there's just a little click I feel like, oh yeah, that's speaking to that. So it's all, you know, like my whole process is very intuitive. And the assumption is if I can go through it and keep changing things until I like it more, then the whole project will be saying more in the end.
Mm-hmm. And I think that the assumption is right. Your editor, Andy Ward, says that Liberation Day is yet another step forward in your evolution as a writer. How do you think your work has evolved over, say, the last 10 years?
Well, I think, you know, I suppose as you get older, you become a little more confident in your view of things. You know, you've sort of lived through pretty much all there is to live through. So I guess I feel like, well, if things feel a certain way to me, there must be some validity to that. And more importantly, you probably have felt it too. You know, in other words, I think as I'm getting older, I'm feeling more convinced that people are quite capable of communicating about the deep things, that all the kind of superficial things that divide us really are real and they're true and they have to be dealt with. But under there's a quality of something. I would call it humanity, really. So if I'm more confident that if I speak to that part of you, that part of you will rise to meet me. And it's just kind of a quiet confidence from, you know, tens of thousands of interactions with people. Whereas when I was younger, I think I wasn't so sure that. And so there's a slightly defensive thing you do as a younger writer, which is to be really smart, fast, funny, cynical, you know, which all those things have their value. But I think they also tend to be sort of like moves to keep the reader at bay, as opposed to the moves I'm trying to do now, which are to embrace the reader and say, yeah, you know, it's like that for me too.
Hmm. Yeah. You've said in the past that the basic idea of a short story collection is in line with your view of the world. So how do you think Liberation Day reflects your worldview at this moment?
Yeah. Well, you know, it was written during the whole, you know, this last 5 or 6 years mostly. The way I feel about it is when you're writing short stories, they don't take 7 years to write one story. Or they shouldn't. Sometimes they do, but theoretically they're quicker than that. So in a sense, what you're doing is you're kind of saying to yourself, okay, how do you feel during this period? Let's make up a situation, even a really silly one, and let's just live in it day after day after day with a lot of concentration, and let's see which part of you that story represents. Okay, then you do that. Then you finish that, and you turn to another one. How do I feel now? And you do it again. And so by the time you've done 9 of these, it's a pretty good kind of maybe slightly distorted or exaggerated snapshot of where your mind was during those years. And the thing that I love about it and that intrigues me so much is it's not really a snapshot that I would have predicted. If you ask me now, write a short essay on how you feel, you know, it would be certain things would come out. But in the stories, they come out in these crazy ways that are somehow more truthful than the story I can tell myself about how I feel. You know, it's almost like a self-revelation or something. And I think that just comes from the fact that you're focusing so hard and you're allowing your subconscious to come out in these focused periods that you even surprise yourself. I love that so much about the form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, I could be wrong about this, but I think that the story Love Letter gives us a really good sense of where your mind is at these days. Can you tell us about it?
If you sort of think there's the surface mind and the deeper mind, that story is very much where my surface mind has been. It's just really a kind of a letter from a very loving grandfather to his probably, I think, maybe 20-year-old grandson. Things have gotten worse. There's a kind of a vague dictatorship in place in the country, right-wing dictatorship. And this grandfather has been, we feel he's been chided by the grandson in a previous letter for not doing more, for being kind of passive and having his head in the sand. So this letter is the grandfather's response, in which he very gently tries to explain to his grandson how this terrible change in American politics happened sort of on his watch. A lot of my feelings, this is sort of written just before the last election, a lot of my feelings about myself were in that story. You know, why am I not doing more? Why do I not know what to do? Why is it that whenever I try to do something, it seems to have no effect? Are we really going to let our democracy sink into the muck with this little feeling about it? So that was the beginning of the story. You put that in there, you know, then again, because it's only part of my feelings, then I just attribute it to this grandfather, who's not me. And then the story starts to distinguish him and starts to kind of attest him, I think, a little bit, you know. So, but yeah, that story is, I mean, there are things that are right out of my life in there, which I don't usually do. And it felt really nice, you know, to kind of say, I'm anxious, here it is, you know, and send it to the New Yorker and say, does this connect with anybody over there?
Mm-hmm. And if I'm not mistaken, you had intuition about the grandfather. You knew the kind of voice you wanted to use for the grandfather, but you weren't sure what the grandfather should do in the story. So how did you deal with that?
You know, one of the things I do when I'm writing is you put something out, and I'm a real obsessive rewriter, so I come back and read it again and again and again. And what will happen is as you're reading it, you'll notice a kind of, I guess I would say, a chink in his armor, the character's armor. So the character is asserting one thing, but under there, you might detect a little uncertainty. And that's where you kind of dig in. So with this guy, he, you know, pretty confidently explains, almost elegiacally, well, yes, this is how we lost our democracy. And maybe it's not that important, actually. Maybe we just have to, you know, enjoy our lives and so on. But I started noticing little kind of almost like verbal tells or ticks that he was protesting too much. So then you start to lean into that and you say, okay, wait a minute, this guy is saying these confident things, but behind there, he's got a doubt. Why? And then you start sort of urging the story in the direction that will test him. So in the story, he finds out that his grandson is, about to do something a little bold and a little against the law and a little rebellious. And he's against that. But then as he starts to kind of piece the thing together in his mind, he sees that the grandson is trying actually to rescue the woman he loves from the clutches of this dictatorship. I think in the last few paragraphs, just lightly, you feel him getting, the grandfather getting really wobbly about his views suddenly. So the story he's told himself for probably 10, 15 years under the pressure of his love for his grandson starts to crack a little bit. And by the end, he's sort of tentatively offering to fund this venture, maybe, we feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. It's a very powerful story. Let's talk about the title story, Liberation Day. It's set in the near future, and it deals with a revolutionary new way of presenting history, if I can put it that way. Where did this story come from?
Oh, boy, that's it's a weird one. And here's how I think about it. I try to get some little nugget of an idea that just is interesting to me and almost like will create a kind of ornery fun. So I start with that. And then the real challenge is to take that kind of playful idea and gradually over many months of rewriting it, cause it to say something that will speak to you, my reader. I feel like you're going to start off by saying, wow, this is weird. How do you think of this? And hopefully by the end of it, it's speaking to you about something that matters to you. And I don't think we even have to necessarily be able to name it. But so almost by definition, if you stick with this weird thing, you know, in spite of your impulses along the way to bail because it's too weird, if you stick with it, you know, then it means that you're engaged, you know, you're in connection with it. So for me, that's the high level challenge. Start with a crazy idea. In this case, it's just the idea that we're in the future and the technology has arrived such that we can take people, and I think the implication is they're people who are in trouble or poor or sick, and we make a deal with them in which we take all of the content of their brain out in order to make room for something else we're going to put in. In the case of our character, he's programmed basically to speak at a really high level about any topic you give him. So that was the first notion. And really, it was just because I wanted to get the chance to make somebody talk funny to me, to be honest. You know, that's so much of it. So then it kind of went from there, you know, and even as I was writing, I'm like, this is some really crazy stuff. And okay. And then the job is to make it crazy, but at the same time, not random, to make sure that these people in the story, although they've been created at a weird offset to reality, that they still behave like human beings. And the assumption is in that process, we're going to find out something about human beings that we might not find out if we were just telling a regular story. The exaggeration is somehow key to producing a certain meaning.
Yeah. There's a story in Liberation Day, a story called Ghoul, which takes place in part of an underground theme park in Colorado in a very hellish area, literally. Can you tell us a bit about this story?
I got a chance to record my first book, Civil War Land and Bad Decline, on audiobook that had never been recorded. So I came out to LA and read it. And I think at first I thought, oh, you know, this is an old book and it'll be kind of weird and I won't like it. And I just really did like it. I enjoyed doing that voice again. The story is in a very strange kind of really truncated first person voice. And enjoyed it so much, I thought, you know, I wonder if I can still do that voice. So I came home and just gave myself the job of trying to write in that voice for a few pages. You know, in that mode, you really, at least for me, I'm really trying not to over-control the topic. I'm just typing, you know, typing, and my energy is on the sound of the voice, and I don't really care what it's saying. So when I had done that, trying to sound like this earlier book, there was this guy who was, it might also have been Halloween, so he's a ghoul, you know, in kind of like a haunted house kind of thing. So, you know, you type up that and I revise it and revise it again for sound. And then at some point you go, huh, that's pretty good writing. I like that. It's funny. And then you start to try to figure out what the heck is going on, because you've made a big mess at that point. You've got an underground theme park that's called Maws of Hell. You've got this guy whose job is to squat all day playing a ghoul. You know, it's kind of irrational, obviously. So then the job becomes, okay, I've said all this stuff. I like the way it sounds. Now let me build the rest of the world around it. But the hope is that at the end of that, it's somehow, you know, the reader doesn't go, that is so weird, it's irrelevant to me. But instead goes, huh, why am I moved by this? Why have I had a wild ride caused by this weirdness? Yeah.
There's a story called Sparrow, which has a very different origin story from most of your stories. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, we were in our house that we used to have in New York State during one of the long winters of the pandemic. And I've been writing, I think I was writing Liberation Day, actually, at the time, the story. And I just woke up one night having had this vivid, vivid dream of a certain voice in my head. There was no dream except the voice. It was just this, and it was something like the first five or six lines of that story, Sparrow. And writers who have dreams, you wake up and you think, that's probably not a story. But in the light of the day, that's going to be dumb, so just forget it. But on this occasion, there was something about it that just, you know, I tried to go back to sleep and that voice kept hearing it or kept doing it in my semi-sleep. So finally, I just said, oh, all right. And I got up and went into the kitchen and turned the computer on and didn't have my glasses. It was kind of dark. But I just typed a whole first draft of that story, which I never do. That's completely unheard of for me. Hmm. And I thought, well, this probably is no good, and tomorrow I'll throw it away. But when I printed it out the next day and read it, it actually was, you know, okay. Then, you know, of course, I revised it for months afterwards. But there's something about that first impulse that was really powerful. It came out pretty much as it is.
In your story club with George Saunders' Substack, you say that at this moment, we seem to be suffering from a widespread failure of literary imagination. How so?
When I say literary imagination, what I mean is this process we've been talking about, where we might start with a certain too simple version of another person or another group of people. And that is certainly the kind of information we get from most of our quick media, you know, from social media and from, especially from partisan media. I think we get, you know, kind of a placeholder for a certain kind of a person. And it's useful. But then the literary imagination says, okay, you know, sure, I'll accept that, but can we poke at it a little bit? Can we look at it from a different angle? Is there anything about that person that maybe is missing in that simple description? It's also a way of thinking that recognize that we're always projecting about other people, and that those projections are always too simple. You know, if I say somebody is a snooty law school professor, well, he probably is. Mm-hmm. But as we say, okay, well, sure, I accept that, but what else is he? Or even saying, can you tell me what exactly you mean by snooty? Can you give me an example? And somebody has to come up with an actual incident in which snootiness occurred. And once that happens, you can sometimes see, oh, you know, what I'm reading as snooty or snobby has an element of, for example, insecurity in it. You know, those kind of things. So the literary imagination is always saying, how so? And can you tell me more? And it's based on the idea that we can abide with people more deeply and longer than we think we can. And the story, reading and writing a story, is a way of just practicing that and maybe reassuring ourselves that we're actually pretty good at that. We're actually pretty good at sitting across the table from somebody with whom we might have some disagreements and saying, well, how so? You know, can you tell me more mm-hmm. about that? Why do you feel that way?
Mm-hmm. Very well said. George Saunders, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Liberation Day. We can't wait to read your next book as soon as possible, but no pressure.
Yeah, there's always pressure. No, thank you so much for having me. It's always great to talk to you.
George Saunders is the author of the short story collection Liberation Day. Find out more about George and his work at WPR.org/beta.
That was the highlight of my career to this date, more so than Saturday Night Live or Weeds or any Adam Sandler film or, you know, whatever I've done.
That's Kevin Nealon. And spoiler alert, the highlight of his career is not his conversation with Beta. Find out what it is in just a moment. He joins us next on Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.